Let me start by asking you, what was your response to the wave of xenophobic attacks and violence that shook South Africa? Do you see this as an outcome of the policies of the South African state in relation to the Mugabe regime?
No, I think that xenophobic attacks on foreigners, especially Zimbabweans, it says that you can easily connect it to the crisis in Zimbabwe. In that, in the first place, the flooding of Zimbabweans in South Africa is as a result of economic and political mismanagement in Zimbabwe. And the limited resources that South Africans and Zimbabweans have to share, which are unplanned. So it's a consequence of the crisis in this country.
Yeah. When, as I said to you before, when we were formulating the questions, we were much more directed to asking you what your perspectives would be as a sort of future leader of Zimbabwe and what type of policies you would be putting in place. But now I think we've really got to ask you about the current situation. Now that you've pulled out of the elections, what is the future? What strategies do you believe a negotiated settlement is both desirable? Do you think it's actually possible with a regime that has sown the type of onslaught of violence against its people?
Well, first of all, the crisis continues, the stalemate continues in spite of our pullout. Because any outcome out of this election is illegitimate. Mugabe knows that, ZANU-PF knows that. I am glad that the United Nations and SADC recently today have issued a statement that those elections must be postponed to a period where this crisis can settle down and people can have a really free and fair election. So as far as that's concerned, we support that resolution by SADC. But we also generally condemn the state-sponsored violence that has been unleashed on Zimbabweans by this regime. It is genocidal, and Zimbabweans don't believe that their government can roll out a military plan against them when they are so vulnerable. So I think as far as the reconvening another election is supported. Secondly, there is the whole issue of a negotiated settlement. One of the realities that we have is that we have two polarized positions. One is that we as a social movement believe in the freedoms and democratic ideals and democratic change. But the nationalist old guard, the militarized nationalist old guard, believe in the rule by force and coercion. So I think that the only thing that is going to force these two opposite positions to be reconciled is when there is a realization that there is need to put the country and the strategic international interests first. And I hope that ZANU-PF will be informed by that value, because we have always been saying that the future of the country is based on inclusiveness and not exclusive monopoly of power.
If ZANU were to say to you, look, we agree, we'll enter into negotiations, let's form some sort of coalition government, wouldn't that be a strike against the will of the people?
Well, there are two fundamental principles that you have to put before you can arrive at that conclusion. One is that the result of democratic elections in March have to be respected, and that the people's mandate was bestowed on MDC and therefore should lead that inclusive government. But that is subject to negotiations. The second fundamental issue is that there has to be peace and stability, and that this banditry and violence has to stop, and the illegal detention has to stop, and ZANU-PF has to bend over backwards and arrest this kind of bandits who are just roaming the country and maiming people. So once we have got accepted that, then it is easier to arrive at a coalition for the sake of a transitional process that will soft land the crisis.
And in this scenario, what happens to a presidential election? Would that be indefinitely postponed?
I think the challenge we have got is that an election is never a solution to our crisis because of the polarization of the two political parties. So if you have, you lose, tails you lose. And I think it's more to do with the role President Mugabe will play if an election is then held. Mm. That's why the negotiations have to be about transition and not about election.
Sure. Now, one thing that obviously would concern you, it concerns us looking at it from this side of the Limpopo River, is of course in any negotiated arrangement with the Mugabe regime, with ZANU-PF, how do you enforce, what is your leverage to enforce any deal that is made? I mean, if they turn around after various concessions and compromises have been made and sort of play hardball like we saw Kibaki do in Kenya, what would your leverage be to enforce any...
Well, the challenge is to find an AU, SADC, UN, Troika, or more than just one place. But it should include President Thabo Mbeki, but include some AU elder, which will act, this Troika will act as a supervisory body on the agreement, and whatever conflict may arise during the transition, they will be able to intervene using these bodies. So that is the only insurance you can have.
Yeah.
You cannot rely on a signature, on a piece of paper with these guys who don't believe in negotiated or compromises, but who believe in roughshod and force and cohesion.
It's precisely why I ask you the question, because you've brought things to the brink by withdrawing from the election. It's unclear to us in terms of how this reduces the pressure on the people of Zimbabwe, given what's taking place now.
I think it was a strategic decision, taking into consideration that the real election, which took place, was in March. This 27 runoff is total war, and as I said in my statement, we cannot be part of a war situation. When Mugabe says, "If I lose, I will not accept the result. I will not accept to leave," and that kind of thing. He has declared war on the people. So why sacrifice people for a result which is already predetermined?
Hmm.
We refuse to go into any power based on dead bodies and the women's hands have been hacked by hacksaws and that kind of atrocities. So I think it was a strategic withdrawal. We believe we withdrew with a high moral, on a high moral ground. Let Mugabe proceed on his illegitimate course, and no one is going to bestow any legitimacy on him.
And what then? I mean, if he proceeds with the election, what's your strategy thereafter?
Well, our strategy is that we follow what the SADC has recommended. Negotiate. And we believe that there is a basis. ZANU-PF says it wants to negotiate, but it wants to negotiate after the 27th when they have stolen the election. We have said that what is important is to have a pact so that the election becomes an event in the long strategy of resolving the national crisis by co-partnership and cooperation. And I think that that is the way to go.
Let's look a little bit into the future now, because it seems to me and seems to many of us here, it's just a matter of time before you have a meaningful role yourself in government and the MDC.
Yep.
Now, two things I think are very important. I think we'd like to hear what the MDC's attitude is to the heritage of the anti-colonial, anti-imperialist struggle. In terms of the future policies of an MDC government, Mugabe makes great noises that he represents the anti-imperialist option and you are simply a stooge of London and Washington. How do you see that?
Well, I think that, first of all, from an analytical point, the MDC is a post-liberation formation. based on the social movements, the trade union movement, and the people's social movements that build up the MDC. So rather than attack the MDC as a, as an extension of colonial imperialist machinations, it is actually a new movement that is a post-nationalist movement to take us from the ideals of the liberation struggle, which were betrayed by these nationalists, and take it further and bestow the real values of freedom on the people. That's why it is based on civil society, the trade union movement, and all these other movements. So the MDC is actually a progression of the people's project to free themselves from colonialism and from the nationalist elite who have betrayed the very same ideals that we fought for.
Could you elaborate what your policies would be in relation to land and agrarian reform? Will you be returning the land expropriated and redistributed by the Mugabe regime?
No, far from it. I was telling somebody today, I said, look, there is a national consensus that the inequality of land distribution in the country is unsustainable, and that we need a new paradigm to assess that land is an asset of empowerment of the poor. But what has happened in our case is that we have replaced an elite white class to own land with a black elite class to own land. So the actual revolution of equitable distribution of land has yet to happen, because the changes that have taken place in Zimbabwe are just asset changes, and they are not about distribution of the very important asset like land. So there is no question about retaining land to anybody. It is about resolution of the fundamental problem of land ownership in the country. And what ZANU-PF has done needs to be re-looked at in terms of rationalization and bringing more people on the land reform program than what has so far happened.
This obviously then sort of brings to center stage future economic policies. And the question would be then, what do you see yourselves putting in place in terms of economic policy to address the tremendous poverty and mass unemployment that currently exists in Zimbabwe?
Well, we are a social democratic movement, and we believe that you cannot distribute. We don't believe that you can have a redistributive agenda without a proper strategy of increasing productivity and production assets in the country. So the reason why we are socially conscious is because we believe that the contribution to the overall productive capacity of the nation has to have a social conscience, and has to have a social responsibility to intervene in the poor, in housing, in education, in health, and the social well-being of the majority of the people.
The Mugabe regime is now essentially a bankrupt economically. We've got huge debts that are still outstanding to the IMF and the World Bank. Will an MDC government be honoring such debts?
Well, we have no obligation. I mean, there is an international law of inheritance. If we inherit all these debts, we may have to find ourselves out, negotiate ourselves out of that debt trap. But what is fundamental is that the MDC believes that we can implement an economic recovery program based on fiscal, monetary, and other interventions that in the short term will arrest the hyperinflation conditions that we now experience, almost 2,000,000% inflation. It's unprecedented. So one of the immediate tasks is to get our debt out of the way, arrest the hyperinflation conditions, and then create the necessary environment for productive sector to start creating jobs and food availability to the nation. But one of the critical challenges that we face immediately is the issue of humanitarian crisis. 4 million Zimbabweans need food assistance. There's no health delivery. There are no drugs in the hospitals. We have no personnel in the hospitals. Our school system has collapsed. So that is an immediate humanitarian intervention that we may have to embark on.
But it does mean that it puts you in a fragile position in relation to the international financial institutions, particularly the World Bank. And I'm thinking here of the situation that we faced post 94, where many of the policies that a new South Africa came into being with many less problems than you face were authored by the World Bank, especially our land policy, willing seller, willing buyer, and so on, that proved pretty disastrous.
Well, we have to accept that you have to deal with these multinational institutions, but you don't have to take their advice. You have to find a way in which you can avert the so-called Bretton Woods institutions' advice by agreeing that your development has to be incremental, responding to the social needs of the planet, but also increasing the productive sector, the land, agricultural output, your basic industries, and that way I think that you in the long term you may avoid these Bretton Woods prescriptions. But you cannot avoid in the short term to deal with the Paris Club and all these other institutions because of the debt trap that we have got. So yes, South Africa had to abandon the RDP. I know at that time I was in the trade union movement and we were discussing the RDP very extensively. Because of the short-term social consensus that had to be built around the Bretton Woods institution paradigm.
Mm. But it does beg the question in terms of what role would you see for the state going forward? I mean, one of the things in the RDP was very much centered around a massive investment program in housing and other things that would stimulate downstream industries. I suppose that's foreclosed in current situation in Zimbabwe.
Well, there will be massive housing that will be needed. But you see, you have to put the cart before the horse. You have to create the necessary instruments and wealth in order to have a social innovation. If you start off by redistribution before creating the necessary productive sector, then you won't go anywhere. I suppose that's what South Africa did, having realized the gaps between the intentions and the realities on the ground. For us, we face huge social problems, and I think that it may be some time before those social problems can be tackled. And by the way, we do realize that over a period of time, we have to move away from donor dependence or donor support, which I think in the initial stage would be the initial infusion of the necessary resources to investment resource-based capacity, your personnel, your manpower resources, your industry, and those kind of investments.
Wouldn't what you're saying just be another version of the trickle-down economic policies that have been generally incapable of averting and addressing extreme poverty and unemployment?
Unfortunately, there is a stage where some form of trickle-down has to be expected, but the state itself cannot play in every area of social endeavor, but it can intervene socially in those basic services, health, education, housing, as a way of providing the basic services and facilities for the poor. But it cannot do anything. It has got its own limitations.
Sure.
But yes, I think that it can give the guiding philosophy as to how the social democratic economic environment has to be created.
Now, South African business seems very eager to invest in a democratic Zimbabwe and have devised various recovery plans. Have you been party to any of these, and what role do you see for South African business in Zimbabwe?
Well, I mean, South African business is welcome to Zimbabwe. I'm sure that there will be a basis of partnership. This is regional investment, and it is attracted. It is important that regional integration is based not only on other aspects, but also that business must be able to move within the region in a manner which then allows for all of us to develop. So South African business will obviously be welcome. And I think that between South Africa and Zimbabwe, they realize the potential of the country in terms of human resources and other natural resources in the country. So they will be able to find a home to exploit business opportunities in Zimbabwe. So it will be welcome.
Of course, in South Africa, there's a sort of governmental transition taking place or shortly to take place with Jacob Zuma, the new president of the ANC, likely to become the next president. Have you had much contact with him and do you see it a different role for South Africa under his leadership?
No, I've not been able to distinguish between President Mbeki and President JZ, because I have a very good rapport with President JZ. I have in constant contact with him. We discuss a number of issues, including Zimbabwe crisis. So I can safely say we agree what needs to be done. So on that basis, at a personal level, there is no problem. And I don't think that there will be any problem between South Africa and Zimbabwe in the future.
But there has been a grave problem between you and President Mbeki.
Not at a personal level. It has been a policy level. It has been a policy difference when it comes to strategy on the question of mediation in Zimbabwe. And I've told him in the face that I don't agree with your soft approach in this, because the man you are dealing with is intransigent. And for a very long time, he has pursued this policy of quiet diplomacy because he believed that Mugabe had to be persuaded. Now, the problem is that the crisis has not ebbed. It actually has reached unprecedented crisis levels. So, but I have met him. We discussed. So it is actually a policy, a principle difference rather than a personal one.
Would you account for his particular role around the Zimbabwe crisis as one in which of an attachment to the Mugabe regime and a support and protection rather than a real initiative to end this crisis?
No, I think that his role was more of strategy failure, because you see, his approach was that he needed to resolve, to manage the crisis rather than to resolve it. And furthermore, his strategy of managing it was based on persuasion of Robert Mugabe, and also the fact that stability was more important than democracy, and of course all those were policy failures, strategically and tactically.
Just a last question, very quickly: what role do you see for Britain and the USA now in the current phase and in a post Mugabe phase?
Well, our policy has always been that as we move in the new Zimbabwe era, we don't discriminate against anyone. We want to be in partnership with every country in the world. We don't discriminate, and we want to promote the commercial interests of the Zimbabwean nation rather than any other belligerent relationship with either East or West.
I've failed to ask you one particularly important question, and that is the role of civil society in Zimbabwe's recovery. How will you manage the demands of the trade union movement over jobs and wages and working conditions on the one hand, and the need to control inflation on the other hand?
Well, I'm sure that there will be. First of all, I believe in social consensus. I believe that the government has a responsibility in consulting labor business. If we have to move forward, there has to be social partnership. Because I think that if we have to face these very hard decisions, you need a buy-in by these social movements. And I'm banking on the trade union movement helping us to plow through and navigate through these very serious decisions that have to be made. I also believe that the trade union movement has to be independent, autonomous, must be a critical player in not only supporting but actually criticizing whatever government is doing. The independence of the trade union movement is critical in becoming an oversight on some of the government policies.